Welcome to Brain Body Movement, a series of talks based on a lecture series of the same title. The talks will be done in a more informal style, so you may wish to consult the printed texts, which are made available to you on my website, www.sam-gill.com. I hope you enjoy the talks. Thank you. The task is to understand and appreciate how we think. I am sure none of us thinks this is an easy task, and I appreciate how, in their book, The Way We Think, Giles Fauconnier and Mark Turner are almost worshipful of the largely invisible and unknown processes they attempt to glimpse for us. And Lakoff and Johnson have written tomes on related topics. In Women, Fire, and Dangerous Things, George Lakoff argues for an experientialist base for thought grounded in the givenness of our embodiment. Simply because we are human bodies, we come equipped with at least two kinds of structures to preconceptual experiences, that is, experiences not driven by concepts. These are basic level structure and kinesthetic image schematic structure. Both structure our experience in ways based on the distinctiveness of the human body. We could then say that these are natural of our bodied nature. Lakoff continues by indicating that there are two ways in which abstract conceptual structure arises from these two structures. One is by metaphoric projection from the domain of the physical to that of the abstract. The other is by projection from basic level categories to superordinate and subordinate categories. In the last lecture, my consideration of the structurality of metaphor led me to question that metaphor is a unidirectional projection from the concrete to the abstract. I proposed that metaphor structurality is better characterized as an incomplete reversibility. The is of the metaphor demands a comparative and negotiative process of entailment mapping. The hidden not of the structurality provided the incompleteness of the reversibility, which gives rise to the chiasm in which creativity and knowledge and meaning may be generated. I also questioned the characterization of the two elements in terms of concrete and abstract, and the implications of the concrete being embodied and the abstract being disembodied or of the mind. I propose to alternately designate the elements of metaphor in terms of visible and invisible. Furthermore, since the invisible is bound to feelings and to emotions, the invisible is also inseparable from the body. Lakoff uses the verb arises to indicate the temporal and value interrelationship between basic level and kinesthetic image schematic structures and abstract concepts. Using his own style of analysis, the word arise is based on the up-down kinesthetic image schema and invokes the metaphor better is up. It designates a temporal relationship which would indicate that abstract concepts come after embodied natural structures, but that the abstract concepts are better or higher. The temporal ordering is, I believe, in service to arguing that body is more basic, more natural than mind, and that the mind cannot function without the body. However, there is, in the word arise, a bit of a residual of the old body-mind separation and hierarchy. I find it difficult to even grasp this temporal and unidirectional projection. If metaphor mapping is unidirectional, then what can be the object on which the entailments of the source are projected? Doesn't there need to be something there, something that has some independently discernible characteristics to be able to receive these unidirectional projections? How do these so-called abstract concepts gain these pre-projection characteristics if not by bodily experience? I don't think these questions can have adequate answers under Lakoff's projection scenario. Therefore, I don't think it is possible to maintain that there can be mappings from a physical to an abstract domain. These problems raise for me questions about the basic term abstract conceptual structure. The word abstract, as it might apply in this situation, would mean something like a general concept without a specific example or a category apart from case. or it might mean an existent only of the mind and thus separate from embodiment, or it might mean ideal or general rather than specific, or something that does not represent external experiential reality. The word concept is then, in some senses, redundant with abstract, in indicating an abstract or general idea inferred or derived from specific instances. It seems that the principal distinction of abstract concept must be its independence from body. When I think through all the implications of this term, it seems to me that if there is no concept existing prior to the metaphoric projection of entailments, then there can be no reversibility, no sense of the fit of metaphoric mapping, no choices made among which entailments of the source term are appropriate. The projection cannot be on to any target at all. It can only be a transformation into another form. The result would be that the so-called abstract concept can then only be a reorganization of the source term. What are the implications of this proposed alternative that metaphor structurality is incomplete reversibility and that both terms of the metaphor are necessarily inseparable from body? Surely we would need to posit that bodily experience is in the shape or structure of metaphor, which has at once both a visible and an invisible, an internal and an external presence. Abstract concepts do not arise from metaphorical projections. They are co-present as constitutive of the structurality of metaphor. Metaphor is not a device to get from one place to another, one level to another, from body to mind. It is rather a resident type of structure readily available to digest, interpret, and expand knowledge and experience. It is an incomplete reversibility that supports oscillatory, playful processes that make meaning and create newness. Metaphor is then a type of perception. But what are the second way Lakoff describes how abstract concepts arise? This is the projection from basic level categories to superordinate and subordinate categories. This is the process by which we move from the basic level category, chair for example, to the superordinate category, furniture for example, or to the subordinate category, say rocker. Basic level categories, Lakoff argues, are the first level to be acquired by children, and they are directly meaningful. So too with kinesthetic image schemas, which are those structuring schemas that come directly from our human bodies, such as containers, paths, links, forces, and orientations such as front-back, part-whole, center-periphery. The question is, in part, is the superordinate category furniture based any less on body and experience than the basic level category chair? Does the category rocker come from a projection of the bodily experience of chair in some way that suggests an abstraction to any degree greater than chair? Again, the term projection suggests a unidirectional process, and I simply cannot comprehend how this is possible, and, were it to occur, how the result can be somehow free of bodily experience. Where I once found great insight in Lakoff's and Johnson's understanding of metaphor as preconceptual, and that the source term of metaphor was based in bodily experience, I now find myself questioning if we can actually defend the existence of anything we might refer to as an abstract conceptual structure. I'm wondering how any of the attributes of the terms abstract or concept can be maintained. Yet our folk understanding of how the mind works is supported by our quotidian language and certainly by academic and philosophical beliefs. What would an alternative look like? As I suggested above, bodied experience creates constantly shifting patternings, such as metaphor and sensory motor programs, that are the means by which we live in the world. These patternings share a structurality of incomplete reversibility. They are all negotiative and oscillatory. They have components that are visible and invisible, external and internal, and therefore are all based on a primitive that we have come to think of as pure depth. Metaphor is of flesh. Following this discussion, it is necessarily a matter of meaning and understanding. It is to place metaphor as a form of perception tipped toward meaning and understanding. Terms that may be more interesting are meaningfulness and knowledge. Based on our folk perspectives, interestingly perpetuated in academia, we expect meaning to correlate with reason and logical resolution, and knowledge to correlate with information and content. However, when we give up objectivism and transcendent reason, as I think we have no choice but to do, and embrace an experiential reality, meaning and knowledge correlate with fit and coherence. Interestingly, there is yet, to my knowledge, a careful discussion of what constitutes fit and coherence. Yet clearly both measures require a comparative and oscillatory processes resolved in a sense of happiness or comfort. Both notably are feelings or emotions. I find it interesting that Lakoff's discussion of knowledge is broadly dependent on vision metaphors and sight experiences. What we find is that the ground of knowledge, the measure of fit and coherence, is belief, feeling, emotion, all inseparable from the body in a visceral way and based on body in other important ways. What is missing from the articulation of these measures of meaning and knowledge is the hidden side of structurality, that is, the absence of fit, the incoherence, the incongruity, the incredulity. While meaning may be measured by the satisfying feeling that accompanies fit and coherence, both of which release one from the oscillatory comparative process driven by the absence of this happy feeling, I suggest, as I have before, that the meaningful is the capacity of something to tease with the promise of coherence and fit, yet perpetually to confound by revealing previously hidden elements that resist fit and coherence. Meaning and knowledge are dynamic processes, perpetuating structures, thorny problems. Meaning is constantly absorbed in these structures, increasingly filling them up, yet only occasionally after long histories, if even then, do they become completely full. When something can no longer absorb meaning, it will be abandoned, no longer of interest. When, for example, do we completely fill the works of Shakespeare so that there remains nothing incoherent, nothing out of place, nothing more to ponder? As such, structures are constantly interrelated with ongoing experience. They perpetually become fuller with meaning. I now turn to Giles Fauconnier and Mark Turner's book, The Way We Think, Conceptual Blending and the Mind's Hidden Complexities. They argue the important point that double-scope conceptual integration, what they commonly term conceptual blending, is crucial to the activities that make us what we are. Conceptual blending is the way we think, from quotidian to high-level cognition, engaged by all people of all mental capacities throughout life. Conceptual blending is done at lightning speed, and we have evolved in such a way that we are not conscious of the process, and further, that we even find it difficult to tease into some presence. Conceptual blending is a double-scope conceptual integration, that is, the mental integration at amazing speed, of two extraordinarily different inputs to create new emergent structures. Fauconnier and Turner state their major claims, and I quote them here. Nearly all important thinking takes place outside of consciousness and is not available on introspection. The mental feats we think of as the most impressive are trivial compared to everyday capabilities. The imagination is always at work in ways that consciousness does not apprehend. Consciousness can glimpse only a few vestiges of what the mind is doing. The scientist, the engineer, the mathematician, and the economist, impressive as their knowledge and techniques may be, are also unaware of how they are thinking, and, even though they are experts, will not find out just by asking themselves. Evolution seems to have built us to be constrained from looking directly into the nature of our cognition, which puts cognitive science in a difficult position of trying to use mental abilities to reveal what those very abilities are built to hide. When these authors consider blending as compared with identity and analogy theory, they write, "Identity and analogy theory typically focus on compatibilities between mental spaces simultaneously connected, but blending is not to obscure incompatibilities, but in a fashion to have at once something and its opposite." We can see that what Fauconnier and Turner understand as blending is similar in important ways to the structurality we have been developing. The way we think is characterized by a structurality that blends impossibilities and improbabilities to create new relationalities, new meanings, new knowledge, new patterns, all the while recognizing, however unconsciously and in hidden ways, that this process is, in some senses, based on sleight of hand and smoke and mirrors. The hidden incompatibilities drive the oscillation. As students of religion, I want us to focus on one of the examples that Fauconnier and Turner give much attention, the Buddhist monk riddle. Let me repeat it here. A Buddhist monk begins at dawn one day walking up a mountain, reaches the top at sunset, meditates at the top for several days until one dawn when he begins to walk back to the foot of the mountain, which he reaches at sunset. Make no assumptions about his starting or stopping or about his pace during the trip. Riddle. Is there a place on the path that the monk occupies at the same hour of the day on the two separate journeys? Fauconnier and Turner use this as an important example to illustrate in some detail the blending processes that are engaged by the riddle. Using diagrams, they chart the initial input mental spaces, the journey up the mountain and the return journey. Using other diagrams, they show cross-space mappings, that is, the correlation between the input mental spaces. Yet, to resolve the riddle, they hold that we create a generic space, in which the separate input mental spaces may be related. This is basically that the upward and downward journeys may be played simultaneously, even though this is physically impossible. Once this is created, then another space is created in which the factors of the question of the monk's riddle can be placed to provide an answer. Basically, one creates a space in which the monk goes up and down the mountain on the same day rather than separated by several days, although there is the knot that it is impossible for the monk to go both directions simultaneously, it is yet part of the way we use blending to think. When it is realized that the monk going up must meet himself coming down, it suddenly becomes clear that there is indeed a place on the path that the monk occupies at the same hour of the day, and that such a place must exist without regard to pace or pauses. Riddle solved. Well, at least in Fauconnier and Turner's reckoning. While I don't contest Fauconnier and Turner's use of this little ditty to illustrate the blending process and its apparent results, I want to show that their approach to the riddle might be more creative. They only scratch the surface of blending. There must be a better metaphor. Rather, they only blended tomatoes and onion when they could have made salsa. First, let's look at the other example of the same situation as presented in the Spanish short story Paginas Inglesas. Here, a man must prove that he was twice on the same spot at the same hour. He has just run down a hill in 20 minutes. The day before, he had climbed the hill in 5 hours, but the 20 minutes are contained in the period of the day spanned by the 5 hours. Now, there are important differences between the monk's riddle and this Spanish character's need for proof. To begin, Fauconnier and Turner refer to the monk's situation as a riddle, but they do not identify the event in the Spanish story using this term. A riddle is a statement or question having a double or veiled meaning put forth as a puzzle to be solved. Riddles purposefully misdirect, and that is why we are fascinated by them. They make us think that we have the answer when our direct pursuit of the obvious misdirects us from the information crucial to the riddle being a riddle. A problem has no misdirection. Fauconnier and Turner consider what they persist in referring to as the monk's riddle without ever acknowledging the distinctive structure of the riddle. In streamlining the riddle as a problem, they also ignore that the traveler is a Buddhist monk, that the monk spent days on the mountaintop meditating, that the journey was to a mountaintop. They gave more attention to the co-presence of car and hiker in the Spanish story, which cannot be literal without the demise of the hiker, than they gave to these details in the other example. They missed the seduction of the riddle by their eagerness to produce a resolution to the problem that, I believe, serves to hide the actual center of the riddle. Here is where we, as students of religion, may be better able to understand the monk's riddle as indeed a riddle. What are some of the blendings we might engage? Well, I am not a student of Buddhism, but I can give a start. As a student of Mircea Eliade, I can say that mountaintops are understood as axes mundi, world axes. A mountaintop is often the point where the creator and created separated as the world came into existence. The mountaintop is where humans go to meet God. Mountaintops are where heaven and earth meet. Mountaintops are where enlightenment occurs, where Moses is spoken to by God, as is Mohammed. Pilgrimages are destined to mountaintops, and so on. Buddhism is often described in elemental terms as an eightfold path, that is, as a journey, and meditation is designated as the following of one of those paths. These paths are often depicted as spokes in a wheel, and certainly the hub is homologous with the mountaintop, with the world center as an enlightenment place. After enlightenment, one is a bodhisattva, an enlightened one, yet still living a structurality where the becoming of physical existence is nullified by the being of the enlightened condition. Well, you all can continue this exploration, which is certainly replete with blendings. Taking this path, the solution to the riddle would then be something like the monk occupies every place on the path at the same hour because, for an enlightened one, all paths, as all times, are co-present. The riddle then returns to the problem of the co-presence, yet now with a blend that requires an excursion into Buddhism. This solution to the riddle pleases in far different terms than does the solution to the problem. And the resulting feelings of happiness arise in the awareness of the blending and co-presence of the wisdom of Buddhism being somehow reflected in a novel understanding of this much simpler matter of temporal co-presence on a quotidian path. Where Fauconnier and Turner observe the aha moment in resolving the problem of temporal co-presence, surely this is nothing compared to the quiet smile that bemuses the face of the one who blends this co-presence with a co-presence of an entirely different order. I can't resist carrying this one step further. Enlightenment, then, in this example, corresponds to the experience of pure depth, thickness, flesh, on which existence succeeds and depends. Enlightenment is a living in the chiasm, that gap where the is and is not, where being and becoming coexist in eternal play or lila. Okay, I'll stop with that. Perhaps Fauconnier and Turner were well aware of this richness and felt it better to ignore it so they could make their blending example in the simplest terms. However, I believe that it is clear that the example, as I consider it, is far richer and more interesting. It also enriches their basic insights regarding the way we think. Finally, I want to turn to the topic of creativity. The question is something like, how do we think a new thought? Or, how do we come up with anything new? In Persian terms, this is a matter of hypothetic inference. In Fauconnier and Turner's terms, it is a matter of certain novel blendings. Keeping Baudrillard well in mind, by creativity I do not intend anything like production or productivity. One of the things I am most concerned about as a teacher is the paucity among students of the sort of creativity to which I point. C.S. Peirce, I think, understood it well. Creativity, as hypothetic inference, is motivated by the experience of surprise, an emotional state that seeks stability and dissipation of unrest. A hypothesis is created to alleviate the conditions that give rise to surprise, so that the accompanying disquiet felt when surprise is relieved. A hypothesis is created to alleviate the conditions that give rise to surprise. Jonathan Smith, following Paul Ricoeur, as I have repeatedly mentioned, holds that incongruity gives rise to thought. Midlife, illness, and other passages may do the same. Crisis of almost any kind is a common stimulant for creativity. Unfortunately, it appears that we must be bludgeoned and whackered into our creative moments. There is perhaps an alternative, and that is to understand the structurality of creativity and to cultivate an appreciation for incongruity or the hidden or seduction or provocation or pure depth or gaps or play. Creativity demands a manipulation of blending and double scope conceptual integration. What drives creativity? Since creativity often seems a nuisance and has the potential to get one into trouble, why seek it? Creativity may be thought of as consciously and purposefully engaging in blending in double scope integration. Creativity may be thought of as attempting to become aware of these blendings, despite our seemingly being blocked from looking directly into the nature of our cognition. We nonetheless may open ourselves to the occasional flashes that are emitted from these blendings, flashes in which we may see anew. Creativity is to participate, even if from the sidelines, in this amazing, indeed awesome process, as Fauconnier and Turner appreciate, is crucial to the activities that make us what we are. To be creative, then, is to exercise that which distinguishes us as human beings. Thank you for listening to this volume of Brain Body Movement, a series of talks based on a lecture series by the same title. I am making this lecture series in print form available to you on my website, www.sam-gill.com. Thank you very much for listening to this volume, and I'll be talking to you again later. Bye-bye.